I'm Jacob Heilbrunn, here today with Kurt Mills, formerly of the National Interest and now the executive director of the American Conservative. And Kurt is a frequent commentator on foreign policy and on domestic politics. Kurt, first thing I want to ask you about today is, of course, Donald Trump. Several hours long conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin. They reached a provisional agreement for a 30-day cessation of hostilities, at least when it comes to energy and infrastructure. What's your take on the conversation?
Yeah, for one, this was vastly overdue. The kind of colloquy that we have seen between the President of the United States and the President of Russia while both of these countries are engaged in a outright Cold War and outright proxy war, I think is richly needed and was richly needed and the kind of thing that hasn't happened very much in recent years, especially since the war started. And really, I don't think the president or the American president and the Russian president have spoken at this length since Biden went and met with Putin in the summer or the early summer of 21. So that was good. In terms of the goal of a quick cessation of hostilities and getting this war to an end, I think today was a little bit of cold water. The Russians seem like they're going to drive a hard bargain. And I think the Trump team is going to have to come up with adjustment and tactics to see this through. I'm not bearish on the prospects of peace. But I think it remains clear that this is no fait accompli and that those who have been saying the Russians don't necessarily have the greatest number of incentives to actually wrap up this war because they are slowly but surely accruing territory, I think we're proven somewhat prescient today. So I think all in all, extraordinary that this occurred, extraordinary that it hasn't been occurring, and there's a lot of work to be done for the administration.
So the Europeans are mobilizing. Today, the German Bundestag or Parliament passed a 500 billion euro package for defense and infrastructure. French President Emmanuel Macron is talking about potentially sending peacekeeping troops to Ukraine to help enforce any ceasefire. Do you think that President Trump has inadvertently created a stronger Europe that he actually didn't want to bring into life?
Oh, I don't know if he didn't want to bring I think he looked at it, and based on all public available evidence and my understanding of the Trump team, they looked at it as doing what was an American national interest. I don't think there was an opposition to a strong Europe. In fact, those who have been saying that the U.S. is paying way too much for European security while the continent maintains a vast welfare state and, is arguably kind of a museum. I think this was further evidence that push came to shove, a strong Europe was entirely on offer. Now, I think the tone, particularly out of the presumptive chancellor, Friedrich Merz, is not terribly productive. He seems like he is a believer in continuing the war, which I disfavor, if you hadn't gathered. And then secondarily, he seems quite anti-American and quite anti-Trump in his tone. And I think that is a disturbing development in this whole process. Macron, of course.
But Kurt, I think you may be conflating anti-Trump and anti-American. Because
no, I mean, his comments have been very clear. We can't trust the Americans. He didn't say we can't trust Trump.
I think is what he means. I mean, the guy has been a staunch transatlanticist precisely because he's been so pro-American.
Well, a true transatlanticist, in my view, wouldn't have a contingent view of America depending on who they elected as president.
Well, maybe he's just being a realist.
Well, sure. But I think you can either be a transatlanticist or a realist, but you and I might part company on that.
I don't think that one precludes the other. Let's turn to another hot button issue. I just saw Trump's press secretary on Fox News breathing fire about Yemen, saying that hell is going to open up if the Houthis continue to resist us, and we're going to stand by Israel no matter what. This war in the Middle East seems to be expanding. Let me put it to you in Trump's words. What the hell is going on?
I think it's a fair question. I mean, with any of the negotiations, I keep going back to the 2017 example when Trump first got elected president with North Korea, where you had fire and fury, and he clearly has for better or worse, this New York real estate wheeler dealer approach where he feels he needs to up the ante occasionally. Additionally, what is different about the Ukraine theater than the Middle East theater is that there is a clear interest group vis-a-vis Israel and the most fanatical champions of the Israeli government's cause inside the United States that want escalation. There's a little bit of this with the Ukraine, but I think it's a pittance, or it's just pales in comparison to what's going on at the Middle East. And so it's very clear, I think, in the next couple of years, if not the next couple of months, that Trump has got to choose peace or Netanyahu.
But I'm a little baffled because Mr. Trump has been a staunch advocate of no more forever wars in the Middle East, yet here we are getting sucked back in. What's going on?
I think it's what I said. I mean, you can look at Trump as a bit of a sort of 19th century political boss in a way. There are different members of his constituency. A major, major, major campaign plank and a major, major, major source of energy and youth support for the president was his No More Foreign Wars pledge and association, which I think is quite strong with Trump now firmly a decade into politics at a major level. On the other hand, though, he clearly has allies, especially within Conservative Inc., official Washington, defense establishment, that want to pursue a hawkish approach to the Middle East that dovetails quite nicely with the prerogatives of the Israeli government that currently sits in Jerusalem. And so I think he is trying to balance it. I think he is trying to balance it and avoid a wider war. I think we've already seen this in action, very reminiscent to the ramp up vis-a-vis Iran in 2019 to early 2020. And, you know, Trump gave the Israeli establishment what they wanted, which was the assassination of Soleimani and a surprise strike, very surprising at the time, everyone has to remember. But on the other hand, was talked out by his populist allies and his own better instincts from a wider war with Iran.
Kurt, for all your talk of restraint, you yourself have been enmeshed in the past week or so in a war on Twitter with John Podoretz, who accused you of trying to curry favor with Tucker Carlson, and then it branched out into the Middle East. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, this is the editor of commentary who is hurling juvenile insults and not really elaborating on his position other than to condemn and attempt to bully all of those that disagree with him. I did not provoke or seek this confrontation with Mr. Podoretz. I merely asked what the U.S. American interest was in striking the Houthis, and all hell broke loose, which just tells me how sensitive and weak the position held by the editor of commentary and his ilk really is.
Do you think it's fair to say that actually there is still a neocon wing in the Trump administration? I know Podoretz himself has been pretty critical of Trump, but
he's pretty close to a downright never Trumper. No,
not quite.
But I think he's pretty close.
Do you think that this Trump enmeshment in these battles signals that there is, in fact, a more perduring neocon influence in the Trump administration than some might like to acknowledge?
I think they fumigated much of the old guard that was there in the first administration. I mean, Marco Rubio is not, or Marco Rubio in this form is not Mike Pompeo. Pete Hegseth is not Jim Mattis. Mike Waltz, the NSA, is not John Bolton. J.D. Vance is not Mike Pence. So it's been a major step change. I'd say at least a standard deviation, if not two, from where we were 6 years ago. And I think it's pretty bracing stuff. On the other hand, Trump himself and, you know, much of the cadre around him, you know, aren't as enmeshed in the intellectual milieu of the day-to-day as much as you or I. And I think, you know, if there's a million things going on, the president can only pay attention to so much. And if someone of reasonable profile, although I think, largely discredited and almost the subject of cruel jokes, more or less these days, like Mr. Podoretz screams bloody murder about, you know, the slightest bit of questioning. I think, you know, occasionally that kind of thing could, you know, make its way up to the high command. But I don't think it really matters that much. I think these guys are on the wrong side of history.
But isn't there some similarities between Trump and Netanyahu? I mean, Trump is talking about annexing Greenland. He's talking about making Canada the 51st state. He's making bellicose noises about the Panama Canal. He's going after the judiciary here now in the United States. Isn't Netanyahu essentially doing the same thing in Israel?
Both are center right, and both are in countries that heavily use the English language. And I think Trump knows a lot of Israelis and knows a lot of Jewish people. And I think Netanyahu has lived in the United States and knows a lot of Americans. So it's not like this is not as far apart as Trump and the president of Tajikistan. But I think the critical difference here is that whatever designs on continental expansion that Mr. Trump might have, very critically, he's not asking any other country to pay for it or support it militarily. America, in that eventuality, which again, I think still remains reasonably far off, maybe not Greenland, would do it itself and not even think to ask anybody else.
So you think if we pay for it, it's okay?
You're asking my view on what specifically?
Well, you seem to be indicating that if we're not if we do this unilaterally, then it's a-okay.
I think if you're running an expansionist operation and then claiming an enormous breach of morality when people don't support your expansionist operation, I think that's a little rich.
So let's talk today a little about something that has also unnerved, let's say, a number of Americans, not just Trump's fairly cavalier talk about expansionism, but also the mounting fear or apprehension that he is laying the groundwork for an authoritarian presidency that runs roughshod, for example, over the judiciary. Today, he is rebuked by Chief Justice Roberts. What's your assessment of those fears? Do you think people are just overwrought, or is there something legitimate there?
Look, I don't think that Trump is a classic Madisonian, and it is almost like getting to be an old conversation at this point. Like he's obviously gesticulated in a way, it's debatable how serious, in the direction of assuming pretty large powers for himself. However, there's just very little evidence that he's altogether that serious or that interested in actually doing it. And in terms of a feuding with the Supreme Court Chief Justice, I mean, come on, please, that's hardly unprecedented in American history.
I think, though, that the Trump has been much more systematic. I mean, you've had presidents who have feuded with the Supreme Court, say Franklin Roosevelt with his court packing scheme, which blew up in his face. But you didn't have a Congress that has essentially gone prostrate before the president. You don't
Sure,
think that's.
that's Congress's problem, not the president's.
But it's something that Trump has helped instill, right? I mean,
I
there's.
don't know. I think Congress's supine nature and feckless reality long precedes and will succeed Trump in all likelihood.
So you think you could have a Democratic president, say, in 3.5 years, where we have a similar scenario where the right then blasts him or her for authoritarian tendencies and the Democrats
Sure.
in Congress kowtow to the president?
Sure. I mean, Republicans across the country, and not just Republicans, independents, and even some wayward Democrats, thought there was more than the whiff of the authoritarian in the nature of A, the Russiagate allegations that were bunk, B, the entire COVID experiment, I'll put it politely, and then C, a lot of the things that the Biden administration tried to do. They didn't speak in the vernacular of the sort of carnival barker approach that Trump often employs, the theatric approach. But in a lot of ways, the totalitarian nature of what a lot of the administration was trying to do, censorship of speech, shock troops in the streets in 2020, occupying a lot of major American metro areas and zones for a lot of people, that was far, far, far more spooky than Trump feuding with John Roberts.
So let's end with the economy, which is what Trump, after all, ran on. The stock market has been gyrating in response to the tariffs. Congressional Republicans seem intent on passing a massive tax cut. How do you feel about the GOP's economic plans? It seems to be sort of a welding together of two wings, doesn't it? They're on the one hand, pro-business tax cuts and for the wealthy. And then on the other hand, tariffs.
Well, I don't think he's anti-business. He's from the business world. And I don't think he's ever really expressed disinterested in tax cuts. So, I mean, if there's a ta anti-tax cut wing, I'm not sure the president of the United States is part of it. Some people in the milieu are. Steve Bannon, the former chief strategist, who's obviously remains enormously influential within this world and in U.S. politics writ large, I think is pretty much on that page. And that might be a harbinger of what's to come in the future. But Trump himself has always married a deregulation and tax cutting comfort
Well, but
internally.
since
Wait, 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 wait,
you
wait, wait,
come.
with external improvements, trade, immigration, and foreign policy reform externally.
But since you come from, the Make America Great wing, the America First wing, are you down with these tax cuts?
It's not the first order of business if I were the president of the United States. But I think the TCAJ extension, the extending the law that happened in the late 2010s, or extending the law in some form. I think there's going to be a big debate over the SALT deduction, and we'll see what happens. I don't think that's the end of the world, and I think that's fine, and potentially could recreate the economic environment that Americans, that many Americans think was so positive in the late 2010s. But I think what you really want to ask, or I shouldn't be, presume, is what I think of the tariffs and the stock market sell-off. And I think it's fine. I think it's entirely possible that we could have a recession in government only from some of these cuts. But I think if the law in the long term, and I think Secretary Bessent, again, I'm just trying, not trying to carry water for these guys, but I think you got to credit where credit's due. I think Bessent's articulations that the American dream is about something more than just cheap consumer goods, read Chinese crap, I think is well taken and overdue. And I think something that would have been easily articulated by a Bernie Sanders administration in another life, many of the populist rabble-rousers in the 1990s and 2000s. And I think their critiques, however stylish and cartoonish to the haters, were far, far, far more correct than their establishment haters, like my apparent rival, John Podoretz, would say.
Why should we be telling Americans what to buy?
We're not.
But if Mr. Bessent declares that we don't need these cheap goods or they're the wrong thing to be
No, he's
buying.
declaring it's not the end all be all that like that that the entire US economy shouldn't be geared around the export of pretty rickety goods from a Chinese slave state. I don't think that's crazy. I think that's effectively how most countries in the world operate, which is pursuing the national interest and having some controls on the access to the markets. And I think this is very similar to.
Is Russia any less of a slave state than China?
Are you aware of how much we trade with Russia versus trading with China? And
I'm just
yes,
saying,
I
I mean.
yes, yes. For the, I mean, China's economy is 20 times larger than Russia's. Number one. Number two, our trade is far more robust. Number three, yes, I think China is actually totalitarian versus Russia's authoritarian.
You're back to the Jean Kirkpatrick distinction.
I think China is fairly controlled, top to bottom,
Why is Russia
one
less?
man
Why is
versus.
Russia only authoritarian?
This is based on what we know. We're just two Americans talking here. But the evidence suggests that Putin is a talented political operative who presides over an unruly collection, a motley crew of business, military, intelligence interests, energy interests, and has stayed top of the heap through means that are far outside the norm of American constitutional government, but are not exactly Stalin level versus Xi Jinping's control of his own party, of his society, of a much larger society, I would add, genuinely frightening and not something we should want to see exported to our shores.
Really, I'm surprised because I think Putin has been progressively cracking down. He has systematically gotten rid of any independent media. He has, you only have puppet or
That's not true. I would say
token parties
there
in
are,
Russia. You have people getting thrown out of windows.
sure, but there is
Seems your
definitely
view
more
seems rather
Russian.
sanguine to me.
There's way more Russian independent media than Chinese independent media.
I
I
don't.
mean, I mean, the Ch I mean, Chinese propaganda is comical, comical. Again, I don't want a war with China. Like, I don't think they should. I don't think they should undergird it. But to the original question, like, we have a major trading partner that engages in all kinds of unfair business practices, and I don't think it's serving the American people. And I think there are ways, again, I've just dumped on the Chinese, but I'll compliment them. I think they have shown to be, reasonable negotiators with, if we just even pursue the issue. I think it's astonishing that no president until Trump in the last 30 years really pursued this issue. And it's so astonishing that his successor, Mr. Biden, who didn't have that much in common with Mr. Trump, largely agreed and kept a lot of those tariffs on the shelf. This is just a new front in the war, but I think it's a correct and just cause.
It is true that Biden was fairly hawkish towards China, but he also was unflinching on the Russia front as well.
I know. I think that's crazy. This is a thing. We're negative $30 trillion in debt. 70% of Americans, I think, we're going in the wrong direction, and we got to quibble over who controls the Donbass
But
and the
that's why
Indi
I want to circle around again to those tax cuts, because I'm perplexed why you think going into a recession is fine and dandy, and
No, I
why
don't think it's
you
fine and
think.
dandy, but I think it's inevitable. The United States hasn't had an organic recession since the GFC, so it's been
This is not an
17 years.
organic recession. It would be an artificially created one.
I suppose if I mean like it, that's like saying like, you have enormous amounts of credit card debt, and this is artificial in the sense that like the credit card companies eventually ask you to pay for it. But like I think trying to do
Not true,
government.
because it would be the equivalent of someone who is earning a lot of money and then
Sure, but the debt's a big
refusing to work as
problem.
much. Because what happens is, if you throw the American economy into a recession, the budget deficit is going to increase. The federal government is going to take in fewer revenues.
We don't know that. We don't know actually know that. We don't know that.
Oh,
That's
you
a
think we're going to have a booming stock market
No, but
during a
I
recession
think it's
because we're
in
going to pay more capital gains taxes?
I think what they are basically thinking is, again, he's a coalition manager. The Musk wing and also some traditional conservatives want to cut government. I think the early results have shown unbelievable waste in government, which is pretty disgusting. And I think a lot of the smarter Democrats aren't really even complaining about it because it's just an open and shut case. I think those cuts, though, do spook the markets, and the market could have a recession this year. I think recessions are always a roll of the dice. This is not necessarily the safest option, but just keeping the government as such, just keeping the status quo, and then just hoping the Republicans don't have a recession again, just from the White House perspective, ever, I think is kind of crazy. A recession in the next 4 years is probably basically certain. It was certain whether or not they did these cuts, they are controlling the stakes in which it occurs at least a little bit.
So Trump is, in your view, is essentially getting the recession out of the way early.
Yeah, I think that's the way a lot of the leading Republicans and administration officials think that way. And I think it's a pretty coherent thing. This is way better to happen in 25 than in 28. Again, for Republican control of the White House. Again, Trump himself might not be thinking all that much about this. It's not him, unless he wants his son to run. But I think, again, the people around Trump, everything you hear is that he is actually using the L word a lot more than he used to, the legacy word. And so he does seem to care about the ship of state that he's handing to his successor. And I think they are taking actions in the direction that indicates that reporting is true.
Well, Kurt, this was a fascinating conversation as always, and we are going to have to continue it. But for now, I think we've given people plenty to brood and ponder over.
Thank you, my good friend.
Talk to you soon.